Well, welcome. I'm Peter Mogazel, the director of the Cystic Fibrosis Center at Johns Hopkins, and I want to welcome you to a program about Pseudomonas eradication. We're going to introduce you to Daniel and talk about Pseudomonas eradication in various ways, through some videos and discussions from the panel, and also with question and answers from you as well. This is a program that's accredited for CME for both physicians and nurses. There's an hour and a half of accreditation through Johns Hopkins Hospital and Johns Hopkins University. The learning objectives for this course are to evaluate the pros and cons of Pseudomonas aeruginosa eradication, summarize the current evidence, get expert opinion that inform eradication decisions and best practices, to discuss some of the key data from significant eradication studies, specifically ELITE and EPIC and ALPINE, to integrate evidence-based strategies to assess and improve eradication of early Pseudomonas infection. This program complies with HIPAA regulations in the United States. The faculty disclosures for the program directors are here, Dr. Boyle's disclosures. And the program, as I said, is accredited by Johns Hopkins Medicine and Johns Hopkins Nursing. The logistics of the program are put together by DK by Med. This is supported by an educational grant from Gilead, but Gilead had no input into the development of the program or the presentations. So let's start off by meeting Daniel. You may recognize some of the other players here. But let me introduce you to Daniel, and we can talk about him throughout the program. This is Mary Ann and her three-year-old son, Daniel. Daniel has been my patient since he was an infant. He was diagnosed by newborn screening. He has two copies of the F508del CFTR mutations. Overall, he's been doing well. Today is not Daniel's regularly scheduled appointment. I've asked Mary Ann to bring him in sooner because his last airway culture grew Pseudomonas aeruginosa.
How did he get this infection?
We don't know exactly where he got the Pseudomonas. It's very common in the environment. About 80% of kids or adults with CF will eventually become colonized with Pseudomonas. And oftentimes we find it on routine cultures when you come to clinic.
How do we know Daniel has it?
Well, as you know, we get a culture at every visit, and the last throat culture that he had grew Pseudomonas.
You said that it was in his throat, but isn't Pseudomonas a lung infection?
You're right. We do a throat culture at every visit, and the culture that we did last clinic visit grew Pseudomonas. You can't be 100% sure that it's in his lungs because the throat culture is not a perfect representation of what's growing in his lungs, but it gives us a good idea of what's growing there.
Should we do more testing?
You could do additional tests. We could do a bronchoscopy to look down in his lungs and get cultures of the mucus from his lungs and see if the Pseudomonas is there. But that's an invasive procedure, and since he's not really having any symptoms, I'd prefer not to do that at this point.
But he doesn't seem sick.
He doesn't, and that's a good thing. The fact that he doesn't have any symptoms means it's more likely that we can eradicate the bacteria. By treating the Pseudomonas early, we have a better chance of getting rid of it. As Pseudomonas stays in the lung, it develops a biofilm, a coating, so we'll try to get rid of it by using inhaled antibiotics.
What do you mean, try?
Pseudomonas is not always cleared when we do therapy, so it's possible that we won't be able to get rid of it, but oftentimes we do. After eradication, though, the Pseudomonas can come back again, and oftentimes does.
If it will come back, why begin treatment now?
Well, it's important to treat early. There's a lot of research telling us that the longer we can put off chronic infection, the healthier his lungs will be. So it's important to try to treat now, get rid of the infection, and prevent it from coming back in the future. So the first question we need to ask is, should we do eradication therapy? I'd like to introduce Margaret Rosenfeld, who's going to be our first speaker.
Good evening. thanks for coming. I'm Margaret Rosenfeld from the University of Washington School of Medicine and Seattle Children's Hospital in Seattle. So I'm going to be speaking tonight for the next 15 minutes or so on a clinical perspective on why eradication is important. The learning objectives of my talk are to describe the importance of early detection of Pseudomonas aeruginosa infection, to describe the rationale for eradication therapy for newly acquired Pseudomonas infection, and to describe the accuracy of oropharyngeal cultures compared to cultures obtained by bronchoscopy for identifying Pseudomonas infection. Okay, so let's just start with some background about Pseudomonas aeruginosa infection and cystic fibrosis. As all of us in this room are aware, it really is the sentinel pathogen in cystic fibrosis, even though there are other important players and communities of organisms. About 80% of adults in the United States are chronically colonized with Pseudomonas, and a particularly chronic infection is clearly associated with more rapid lung function decline and chest x-ray score decline, poor nutritional status, more frequent hospitalizations, and ultimately poor survival. Pseudomonas is, in general, initially acquired from the environment as opposed to patient-to-patient transmission. And the environmental strains presumably enter the host through the lower airways by inhalation or perhaps from upper airway reservoirs like the sinuses. Initial Pseudomonas isolates are typically non-mucoid. They're present at relatively low density, and they're highly antibiotic sensitive, which offers then a window of opportunity to eradicate these infections before they become chronic. And therefore, current guidelines of care really do emphasize early detection and antibiotic treatment of earlier initial Pseudomonas infection. Pseudomonas is acquired in childhood at a rate of about 16% per year. In other words, you have about a 16% risk of acquiring Pseudomonas each year of life in the first 6 or so years of life. There really have been relatively few risk factors identified. So high risk CFTR functional class puts you at a greater risk for earlier acquisition. That includes F508del and living in warmer and wetter climates as well. Not a lot of other risk factors are known, though. As opposed to chronic infection, initial infection is certainly not associated with overt changes in clinical status. There's not a dramatic drop in lung function or a clear change in height or weight, or for that matter, generally symptoms when Pseudomonas is initially acquired. However, after initial Pseudomonas acquisition, there is a greater likelihood of hospitalizations as compared to prior to acquisition. In the pre-eradication era, Pseudomonas isolation before the age of five was associated with poor 8-year survival, but that study is from the 1990s, and in the Pseudomonas eradication era, that has not been repeated. As you're probably well aware, there is a transition from initial to chronic infection that generally progresses over a period of years. And there are both host and pathogen characteristics that promote the transition to chronic infection. In terms of host factors, the dehydrated airway surface liquid and abnormal mucociliary clearance that's the hallmark of cystic fibrosis makes it easier for the bacteria to persist in the airway. There's also impaired function of antimicrobial peptides, the innate immune system, and neutrophilic inflammation, which is there to try to clear the pathogen, but also does some collateral damage to the airways, causing bronchiectasis and then setting up for poor mucociliary clearance in turn, so there's a vicious cycle. Pseudomonas has multiple mechanisms to adapt to the CF airway milieu and lead to chronic airway infection, including, as was already mentioned, biofilm formation. So the communities of Pseudomonas, and in fact other organisms as well, can begin existing in these structured communities. They're encased in an alginate matrix. There's also development of the mucoid phenotype, and both of these lead to increased antibiotic resistance. Therefore, chronic Pseudomonas infection is extremely difficult to eradicate with antibiotics. So just to review the stages of Pseudomonas infection, at first acquisition, we now recommend early anti-pseudomonal eradication treatment regimen. And if the eradication is successful, then the patient develops a pseudomonas-free state again, but is, as Dr. Mogazel mentioned in the video, likely at some point to become infected a second time, and then more treatment is offered, leading to hopefully successful eradication again, but again likely to come back. And since the standard of care in the United States has been offering aggressive anti-pseudomonal antibiotics at the time of isolation, we don't have a good idea of how long this pattern goes on before there may be chronic infection. That's a subject of some ongoing research. But unfortunately, it can also lead to a failure to eradicate and eradication failure at any point in time. And then the individual is at much higher risk for chronic infection, which again tends to happen over years. So now let's move on to discuss how to detect Pseudomonas infection, which, as Daniel's mother asked some very intelligent questions about it, is not straightforward at all. So detection of infection in patients such as Daniel is quite challenging because, of course, these young patients typically do not expectorate sputum. So that we are relying on oropharyngeal swabs or else more invasive tests such as bronchoalveolar lavage, each of which has distinct advantages and distinct disadvantages. In the United States, oropharyngeal swabs are the usual source of microbiologic specimens, and they're recommended to be obtained at least quarterly. Though, as I'll talk about in a second, the diagnostic accuracy for oropharyngeal cultures compared to the lower airway cultures is not great, there may be some importance of isolating Pseudomonas from the upper airway in its own right, as it may serve as the reservoir for lower airway infection. So our group and others have looked at the diagnostic accuracy of oropharyngeal cultures compared to bronchoalveolar lavage obtained at the same time. Dr. Wainwright's group has also done this. And we've all found similar things, which is basically a higher specificity and a higher negative predictive value than sensitivity or positive predictive value. So just to put this in plain English, if you do not isolate Pseudomonas from the upper airway, it's relatively likely not to be in the lower airway. But if you do isolate it from the upper airway, that's no guarantee that it's actually also in the lower airway. So now, lastly, let's move to a little bit of introduction about antibiotic treatment of early Pseudomonas infection. So the objective of such treatment is to eradicate Pseudomonas while it's still antibiotic susceptible and present at low density. We talked about how there's a window of opportunity to treat early on because of characteristics of early Pseudomonas isolates, and once the infection becomes chronic, it's difficult or impossible to eradicate. It was the Copenhagen CF Clinic back in the 1980s that originally proposed this strategy that's now become the standard of care in most countries. However, as we'll be discussing, there is not universal consensus on the most appropriate protocols to use. Dr. Tiddens will be going into more detail on this, but approaches have definitely included inhaled, oral, and IV antibiotics alone or in combination and for various different amounts of time as well. In general, these regimens have shown relatively similar and relatively high eradication rates, though again, Dr. Tiddens will be going into more detail there. The clinical efficacy is distinctly more difficult to evaluate than the microbiologic outcomes. And unfortunately, it's somewhat difficult to compare results across studies because of different eligibility criteria, different endpoints, and in particular, different definitions of eradication success or failure. So there are two relatively recent consensus statements, one from the European group and one from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation here in the United States. And I won't read those to you, but both of them definitely recommend tobramycin solution for inhalation as first-line therapy for initial or early Pseudomonas infection. So in summary, tobramycin is the most widely recommended treatment, but the optimal regimen is still far from known. Eradication success is generally high, but there is about a 20% failure rate. And so we may need personalized approaches based on a risk factor profile. And then importantly, despite eradication of Pseudomonas in most cases, we still definitely see bronchiectasis, air trapping, and abnormal lung function in young children, So what's going on there? If we're eradicating the bacteria, is it due to inflammation associated with the bacteria that's not turned off? Is there a role of this whole community of microorganisms that we're coming to call the microbiota? What are the other things that we're not successfully treating with antibiotics? Thank you.
We've talked about the benefits of eradication therapy, but I want to make sure you understand what it entails. My plan would be to have Daniel get inhaled antibiotics. Inhaled antibiotics aren't approved for kids less than 6, but we use them frequently, even in little babies. The goal is to get as much antibiotic, as much medicine into the lungs as possible, and this is the best way to do that. So there are 2 antibiotics that we could use that are inhaled. We use inhaled tobramycin, which is a medicine that's recommended by the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation guidelines.
Are there side effects?
There can be. Some kids cough with the therapy and can have a hoarse voice. Children that tend to wheeze can wheeze with antibiotic therapy. However, many kids like Daniel tolerate the antibiotics without many problems.
Is the nebulizer difficult to use?
It is not difficult to use. It may be a little bit different from one you've used in the past, but I'm going to have Sherry, our respiratory therapist, come in and go over it with you. Can you take a big breath? Can you do it again? Good job. So can you do that when you're doing your treatment? I bet you can. That's very good.
The most important thing is that you keep everything clean. The treatment itself lasts about 15 minutes, but setting it up and cleaning it at the end will take a little bit more time. The first thing you're going to do is take the nebulizer cap off, take the ampule of medication, make sure you squeeze all the medication out and the ampule is completely empty. It's also important that you keep the lid very tight and secure before the treatment.
To get the most medicine into his lungs, Daniel needs to breathe through his mouth. He'll need to use a tight-fitting mask, and you'll need to get him to sit quietly and breathe deeply for about 15 minutes. The nebulizer will make a sputtering sound when the medicine is gone.
After the treatment is finished, you will need to clean all the parts. You can clean them with warm, soapy water. Dishwashing soap is good. At the end of each treatment, you want to disinfect all the parts. The best way to do that would be to boil them for 5 minutes with distilled water. Just make sure all the parts are dry before you put them away.
It's not all that complicated, but it is time consuming. But inhaled antibiotics are the best therapy for both Pseudomonas eradication and for chronic therapy.
I think we can handle it, right, Daniel?
Yes.
So good evening. I'm Harm Tiddens. I'm from Rotterdam, Netherlands, and I think the organizers were having me here. So I'm going to address the treatment options. What are the approaches for treating Daniel? My learning objectives: to describe effective approaches to eradication therapy for newly acquired Pseudomonas infection, to describe the advantages and disadvantages of various Pseudomonas eradication strategies, and describe the importance of adherence and proper administration technique in the success of Pseudomonas eradication therapy. Okay, so what do I consider when I sit in my outpatient clinic and when a patient like Daniel comes in? The age, 3 years, of course. Cooperative and non-cooperative. Socioeconomical, of course, will be different, of different importance in some countries. What is the history of Pseudomonas infection of this boy? What is the phenotype of the Pseudomonas? Is it mucoid, like what you see on this plate over here? And what is the evidence out there in the literature on the efficacy of various treatments? And those I want to discuss. And actually, I'm not so confident about this, I must say, because all those studies have different details. But I want to just to point out some what I think are relevant issues. So I was actually very skeptical the aerosol could eradicate, but then the study, heroic study by Ron Gibson, came where young kids were actually had an infection. They had a lavage to really prove that they had a lower airway infection with Pseudomonas, and then they were treated for 1 month with twice daily 300 milligram. And he succeeded in this trial of eradicating in 63%. And that was established at 8 weeks after treatment was completed. So the next study is the ELITE study. And again, patients were randomized to 28 days or 56 days of tobramycin treatment. And what is important about this study in understanding the results is that patients who had positive antibodies were excluded actually from randomization. So one quarter of patients actually were not included in the randomization process. But if you now take those patients who were randomized, then at 4 weeks after treatment, 92% cleared. If you now take the patients who, and actually for the endpoint, they included patients who 4 weeks after completion of treatment didn't have Pseudomonas, and those were followed up, and those were 65 patients, and they of those patients at 12 weeks after completion of treatment, 86% cleared Pseudomonas. So then there is the EPIC study. It's a complicated study. I'm not going to lead through the setup, but what was important is that in two arms, tobramycin solution was compared to tobramycin plus ciprofloxacin. In that study, it was a large study at 10 weeks, and I had some difficulty in finding the number, but actually 87% of patients cleared Pseudomonas. I think what is an important message of this summary is, first of all, how do you determine eradication, successful eradication? Is it 1 month after completion of treatment? Is it 3 months? And what is your inclusion criteria? What patients have we studied over here? So the next list shows three more studies by Tachetti, and comparing 1 month of tobramycin with ciprofloxacin versus colistin 1 month with ciprofloxacin. Again, a study that, and I forgot to tell you in the previous slide, about half of the patients included were actually children below the age of six, so in the age range of Daniel. So again, in this study, 66% eradication, and there's the study from my Belgium colleagues who compared tobramycin versus colistin plus ciprofloxacin, and the latter was given for 3 months. And in that study, there was, depending on the duration at which you evaluated eradication, it varied between 44 and 65%. Then there is the Alpine study. It was recently published, investigating the efficacy of three times daily S3NM nebulization. In that study, 47% of children were children, and at 28 weeks, 58% cleared actually Pseudomonas. If you now take from this study patients, because in this it was important in this study that patients were included independent of their Pseudomonas antibody status. If you just focus now on patients who were had negative Pseudomonas antibody, actually the clearance rate is in exactly the same rate as the ELITE study. So I would say that the numbers are pretty equal between those between all those studies. So just to highlight a couple of studies, and this is again a study by Ron Crystal, by Ron Gibson, and where he did at baseline élevage was done, and that shows the discrepancy between what you culture in the oropharynx and what you culture at the élevage, because all patients had a positive result, culture result from the élevage, but still the oropharyngeal culture was negative in two patients. And then you see that the follow-up, and what's important here is that at day 84 in this cohort, they had again a lavage, and you see that there are at that time point four patients that didn't clear. Importantly, there are two patients who had a mucoid strain and they didn't clear, and that we know that that's mucoid strains are difficult to eradicate. So this is the next study, and I think actually trying to for me, thanks to Peter, then I have to study this all again. I try to understand how to compare those studies, and I think they should be depicted in the way shown here in the study from Belgium, that to show a survival of a Pseudomonas-free survival curve and comparing the two regimens. And then you actually, from this curve, you can understand that, so here at time zero, all patients had cleared the sort of after treatment, those patients who cleared the Pseudomonas, and you see how the survival curve for patients, how long they remained free of Pseudomonas. And the big change is especially in the first month after you complete your treatment. So I think this kind of analysis helps you really to understand what happens in such a cohort. So this is some more detail about the Alpine study. So let's see from this study what we can expect for Daniel. So first of all, the age, 2 to 6 years, and you see from that at week 16 that 62% cleared the Pseudomonas. And what's important here, there doesn't seem to be a very big difference between the age categories in your chances of success or failure. So 5 minutes, I have to hurry. Oh no, I get 2 extra minutes from Margaret. She left me 2 extra minutes. So the Pseudomonas history, so this was his first infection, which means again a 66% chance of clearing. And if it was a recurrent infection, then actually your chances of clearing are lower. So your baseline culture, In patients who had in the study 2 consecutive cultures within a short time frame being positive, your chance of clearing is actually lower. And it might represent a higher bacterial load why your chance of culturing twice positive is higher. Mucoid, we already stressed that if you have a non-mucoid strain, your chance of clearing is higher. In what's surprising in the Alpine study, it was actually one, but it's of course only one observation of a patient who cleared a mucoid strain. And for Daniel, we don't know anything about his antibody status. So what is known, I think, that if you have a history of positive Pseudomonas, your chance is that you chances are lower of clearing the Pseudomonas. Elevated antibodies, the same. If you have 2 positive cultures within a short time frame, your chance of clearing are lower, and if it's a mucoid strain. So what is unknown, what has not been properly investigated, what's the important, so especially in the young, very young kids, are the chances really equal of clearing the Pseudomonas? What about severe structural lung disease? What about the distribution of disease, central versus small airway disease? What about the concentration of the inhaled antibiotics in diseased areas? I'm going to explain this a little bit more. What about the adherence to treatment? Poor inhalation competence, uncooperative character, the one that I showed you, and poor socioeconomic conditions. So in a nutshell, age. So on your left side, you see the bronchial tree of an adult, and there's a particle 5, 3, and 1 micron. The large particle have a high probability of getting deposited in the near bifurcation, central airways, turbulent airflow. And the smaller particles have a higher probability of making it all the way down to the smaller airways. On your right, you see the bronchial tree of a healthy child, actually in the middle. And there also the particle of 3 micron has a higher probability of getting deposited. Why? Because the airways are more narrow and the flows are higher in children. And of course we don't talk about treating healthy children, we talk about children who have inflamed airways, who have mucus in the airways, so obstructions. So it's also for the smaller particles they have a higher probability of getting deposited centrally. And is this important? Yes, because if you look at these 2 CTs on your left side, a child who's doing quite well, oops, sorry, I shouldn't have done that, please go back once. So here, quite a normal CT at the age of 2, and here on your right side, a child who actually has, at the age of 2, Pseudomonas, has severe bronchiectasis, mucus impaction, and large areas showing small airway disease. So there is a wide heterogeneity in structural abnormalities of the patients, even at that age range. And that is shown in this next slide, where we use the PRAGMA CF score to compute the volume of lung which shows abnormal features. In this case, bronchiectasis, mucus plugging, and bronchial wall thickening. And so here on the x-axis, you see the percentage of the lung which has these abnormal features. And on the vertical axis, you see actually the number of patients that had that percentage, so the frequency distribution. So there are patients who hardly have any damage, while on the right side, you have patients with 16% of the lung is already showing quite some damage. So heterogeneity. Also, if you look at the small airways, we compute again the volume of what is called trapped air, representing small airway disease, and you do that on the expiratory scan. And again, a wide distribution of severity, patients with 1% trapped air, while on the other hand, there are patients with 60% of trapped air. So why is that important? If you inhale your medication, you're healthy, you have a homogeneous distribution of your inhaled aerosol, as you see on the left side. While if you have diseased lung, there will be a preferential flow to the better preserved areas, thanks to the increased airway resistance in the diseased areas and the slower expansion of such areas, and also increased deposition at the sites of obstructions. If you want to read more about it, this paper is going to appear, I hope, very quickly, because it's in press. So is that true? So what about this distribution of your inhaled antibiotic? Well, in the literature, you read a lot about the high... Oh, I press again this light. Don't go ahead. So you read about the high concentrations in sputum, but you have to remember that that represents central airway deposition. High concentrations in the sputum, central airways. Your microorganisms are homogeneously distributed and maybe even more prevalent in the small airways. So you have a concentration gradient from your antibiotic going from high in central airways to lower in the smaller airways. So it leaves us with a number of questions. What are the concentrations in the small airways? What is the impact of your breathing pattern of how much of the drug you get there? What is the influence of particle size? What is the influence of structural lung changes? So we investigated this in a study in our patients, because we wanted to model what were the concentration in this case of S3NM, and we want to investigate its relation to the concentrations throughout the bronchial tree and to see whether it was affected by structural changes. We used computational fluid dynamics, and we used the scans routinely made in our patients, inspiratory, expiratory. I will not go into details. But these are the results. So on your left side, you see a color-coded map of the concentration throughout the bronchial tree of the reconstructed bronchial tree of the patient. And what you see is everything above yellow is actually adequate concentration. So central airways, you see that the concentrations are okay, while in the small airways over here, you're still in the yellow range, it's still okay. But this patient is with more structural disease. You see there is a high, very high concentration central airways and more inhomogeneous pattern in the segmental bronchi, and the smaller airways are actually have insufficient of the drug. So from this study, we learned that most lobes, the concentrations are okay, especially the lower lobes, but the upper lobes, actually the concentrations are lower. And in case, for a modeling study, if you model the worst case scenario, actually up to 28% of lobes would receive insufficient drug. So this seems to be play a role, and we have to keep in mind, and I'm running 2 minutes over time now, that concentrations are not homogeneous. So to summarize, the success rate of in eradication varies widely, 44% to 92%, depending on your inclusion criteria and on the criteria for eradication. And we know the success rates are lower when you have two or more positive cultures before start therapy, positive antibodies, mucoid phenotype. And there are other risks of failure, like poor adherence, poor inhalation competence, and severe structural lung disease, and uncooperative child. I made you clear that if you already had once Pseudomonas, or encountered Pseudomonas in your life, your chance of eradicating will be lower. Thank you very much.
Hello. Well, my name is Donna Peeler, and I am the pediatric clinic nurse coordinator at Hopkins. And I have worked with patients for many years, and I'm glad to see that there are a lot of nurses here, because really I think the physicians, what they have been presenting, they often hand that baton then off to us. They have given the families the information about Pseudomonas and what the treatment plan is, and then we are to help them carry it out and figure out how they were going to do this. So the ideal setting is in the clinic, but oftentimes they may be getting a phone call from the physician because that result has come in after they've left clinic, and then I will follow up with them, and I usually, if there's been too much time in between conversations, I get a lot of questions after they have investigated what Pseudomonas is and some of the concerns. I would say in the years that I've been doing this, and cultures are routine, but it is never a routine phone call when you have to call a family, whether it's a young infant, a toddler, or a teenager, to tell them that this is their first positive culture for Pseudomonas. So typically I will talk, if I'm talking to a younger patient and their family, if they have never done nebulizer treatments before, then we're starting from ground zero, ordering equipment, making sure they have the proper compressor, nebulizer cup, proper fitting of the mask, and if they have done albuterol treatments or something like that in the past, then I really ask them to show me how they've been doing it, because a lot of them do blow by. So we go through a whole reteaching of how to do proper nebulizer technique with inhaled antibiotics. For our older patients, they may have already been on many nebulizer treatments, so the emphasis is again on their technique, the order of their medications that they're doing, and if they really understand what each medication is for in conjunction with their airway clearance. And for them, this is obviously an extra treatment burden. So I kind of have gone through some of the medication side effects, what they can expect, what things they should alert us to, and what things we are not concerned about. Some of them may need help with patient assistant programs, so getting them connected to that, make sure no prior authorization is needed. And some of the tips, maybe again for some of the younger patients, as we saw in some of those videos, is you do not want to force a treatment. You don't want to do it during a time when they're really tired or hungry. I know many parents have told me that they sometimes do wait until the babies fall asleep, and that's not ideal either. But or they will try to confine them to the ones that are running around, to some kind of stationary chair where they can entertain them, keep them still for long enough to do treatments. But I think the key element for all ages is supervision. Obviously, the younger ones need hands-on, but the younger teenagers, I think I'm going to start recommending hidden cameras while they're very autonomous doing their independent treatments, that the parents could find out a lot about how they're doing their treatment. But it's been proven that if a parent is just in the next room, they may not be directly standing there watching them do it. It makes a big difference in their technique and in their adherence. And then the final thing that we have to go over that's of utmost importance is the cleaning and disinfection. And again, the difference between cleaning and disinfection, those are two different steps, and replacement of nebulizer cups and filters and the compressors. We use a lot of handouts. There's some wonderful website guidelines to reinforce this. And there's also sometimes a gap in the time that we go over a lot of this and they get their medication. So sometimes they're coming in after they've gotten their medication, and we can reinforce some of the teachings, hands-on. So really, that's all that I have. Oh, I didn't go over my objectives. So let's hope I met them explaining the rationale for Pseudomonas aeruginosa eradication protocol to the patient and family. That's reinforcing it after the physician has explained that, explaining medication side effects, order of medications, and the equipment cleaning and disinfection with patient and family. Thank you. Thank you.
We attempted Pseudomonas eradication with Daniel using inhaled tobramycin. He tolerated the therapy well, and so did Marianne, his mother. She developed a system for treating him, cleaning and disinfecting that worked for her, and after 28 days of treatment, a follow-up throat culture did not grow Pseudomonas aeruginosa. However, his routine throat culture 6 months after that found that he was infected with Pseudomonas again. I've asked Marianne to bring Daniel back in today to discuss our options for next steps.
We did everything we were supposed to do, so why did the infection come back?
We're not entirely sure. It could be that the eradication didn't work, that we failed to clear the bacteria the first time because of resistance. Or it may be that the eradication did work, the Pseudomonas went away, and now he's infected with a new strain of Pseudomonas. So we have a few choices at this point. We could do another treatment with inhaled tobramycin alone, or we could add a second antibiotic, an oral antibiotic like ciprofloxacin, so you do tobramycin and ciprofloxacin. It's also possible that he's actually chronically infected with Pseudomonas, and we should start chronic therapy, where we alternate an inhaled antibiotic every other month.
For how long?
If that's the case, it would be indefinite. It might be a lifelong therapy. I'm not quite ready to commit him to that, though. I think we should try eradication therapy again, but this time use a different antibiotic. There's another antibiotic we could use. It's called inhaled aztreonam. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes to administer, and it's done 3 times a day instead of 2x a day, the way tobramycin is. And there's data showing that it's effective as well for eradication therapy. The side effects are similar to what you see with inhaled tobramycin, things like coughing, sore throat, and occasionally wheezing. There are some more rare side effects that we could talk about as well.
Is the same nebulizer used?
It uses a different nebulizer. It's specially made for aztreonam. It takes about 2 to 3 minutes to administer the medicine 3 times a day, and Sherry can come in and show you how to use it.
Now, this nebulizer is a little different. When you take the lid off, make sure you don't touch any parts inside the reservoir. It could clog up the head. The medication comes in 2 parts. The first part has the powdered medication down in the bottle. You have a metal tab. What you'll do is you'll need to pull the metal tab off, and then take the rubber top off of it, and take one of the saline vials, squeeze all the saline down into the vial, put the lid back on, the cap back on, and gently swirl the medication. Once you see that all the powder is dissolved, then take the rubber cap off, open up the nebulizer lid, and pour the medication down in the reservoir. Once you get the medication down in the reservoir, make sure the cap is back on tight. After each treatment, you'll want to clean all the parts of the nebulizer with some warm water and some dishwashing soap. And then you want to disinfect all the parts. The best way to do that would be to boil them for 5 minutes with distilled water. And then once they're dry, then you can put them back in the container until the next use.
So are we in agreement that we should go forward with the aztreonam therapy for eradication?
I'd like some time to think about it and talk to my husband.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Well, good evening. I'm Claire Wainwright, and I'm from the Royal Children's Hospital in Brisbane. And I'm going to talk to you today about what to do when reinfection occurs. Now, the learning objectives for this section are to identify risk factors for recurrent Pseudomonas aeruginosa infection, to describe the approaches for treatment of recurrent Pseudomonas infection, and to describe methods used to define chronic Pseudomonas infection. So I'm going to start with this slide, which you've already seen, and really it's just to show you, again, the idea that you can be you can actually clear the infection and then start again with treatment, but at each time point, each infection here as you go up, there's an option that you might not clear it, in which case you're regarded as chronically infected. The problem we've all got is exactly how to define that. There are not many multi-site longitudinal studies that have followed children from birth or looked at the prevalence of reinfection. Now, the prevalence of reinfection is likely to depend on a number of things. It's likely to depend on the time you monitor, and it's also likely to depend on the treatment received for the initial infection, the timing of that, the treatment that was given, and adherence, etc. So for example, as you saw in the previous presentations, if you're not actually taking the treatment, then it's not going to work because it's not a good lucky charm. So it depends on how you had it. It may also depend on other treatments that you're getting. So there's a very interesting abstract at this meeting looking at inhaled corticosteroids, for example, and the risks of infection with Pseudomonas. We think that staph prophylaxis may also increase risks. Geographical site may be important, and particularly places that have warmer climates. And then there's the type of sample collection. So you've seen that there may be differences between upper airway collection and BAL. What about the frequency of sampling? Well, if you only ever do a BAL once a year, you're clearly only going to find your Pseudomonas once a year, so it's going to affect the frequency that you find it. Then there are definitions. So if you're doing a BAL, how much Pseudomonas is important? One Pseudomonas? 10? 100? 1,000? Where do you draw the line? What about age? We've talked a little bit about age, but I suspect age is important, but we really don't actually know very much about it. So let's look at the couple of studies that we have got, which have looked over time at children in the same sort of age group as Daniel. So let's look at, first of all, the EPIC protocol study, where there was a comparison done between historical data from the epidemiological study of cystic fibrosis, there's large numbers here, and the EPIC trial. And the mean age here was 5.5 years, so the average age was a little bit older than Daniel, but it did include infants right down to to the first few months. The length of follow-up of this study was 80 weeks, so around 1.5 years. And 35% of children in the EPIC study and 54% in the historical cohort had Pseudomonas recurrence. So there are differences there in between those two studies. And the differences may be related to, in the historical cohort study, the treatment protocols were less regimented. There was less early treatment compared to the EPIC study. And the problem here is that there were only OP cultures collected and no genotype collected on the samples. So we don't really have a good idea of whether the recurrence was due to the same genotype. And on top of that, there was some inconsistency in OP cultures in the historical group. Now this study was a study that was a clinical trial across Australasia. And in this study, children were randomized to either have BAL or OP cultures. And they were randomized in the first few months of life, and they were managed right the way through to the age of 5. They all had OP cultures, and half of the cohort were randomized to BAL, and half to the OP cultures throughout the study. But they all had a BAL at the end of the study at age 5. Now, in the study, 82 out of the 157 children who were followed to age 5 acquired Pseudomonas in the first 5 years of life. And 44%, so 36 children, reacquired Pseudomonas in that time. There was an average of 2.8 years of observation post the first acquisition. Now there are many single-site, smaller studies that have looked at the prevalence of reinfection. So if you look through these studies, you've got smaller numbers, they're single site, and there are various ages included. So in most of the studies, they're children that are quite a lot older, so not quite so relevant to Daniel. But you'll see that the rates of reinfection vary from 100% from the middle study in this slide, the monk study, to around 51%. So it's quite variable. So the best estimate of prevalence of reinfection with Pseudomonas in young preschool children I think, would be between 35 and 44% of children who receive initial prompt treatment over the next 2 to 3 years. And that's based on two of the largest studies, so the EPIC study and also the BA, the ACF-BAL study. Now we get to the next question. Is it reinfection or is it treatment failure? So the only way we're going to know that is if you genotype the samples, because clearly if it's a different genotype, then it's more likely to be a reinfection. Now if it's the same genotype, it doesn't exclude the fact that you could have been reinfected with the same genotype. But certainly you can exclude the persistence of infection if you've got a different genotype. What about the site of sample collection? Well, let's look at site and genotype. The Munk study, they used either sputum or an NPA, really, a catheter passed through the nose to the laryngeal aperture. So the two different sample types in this study. And 14 out of 19 acquired a new genotype. And the other study here looked in a smaller number of patients who had chronic infection. 10 had identical Pseudomonas genotypes out of the 11. So they pretty well all had the same genotype. But in the 7 out of the 14 who didn't become chronically infected, half of them had an identical genotype. So it increases the risk, but it's quite difficult to be sure. Going back to the ACF-BAL study, what about the BAL group? Well, let's look at these. 39 out of 79 children who were randomized this group had cultured Pseudomonas in the BAL. And we had a cutoff in terms of what we thought was a significant amount of Pseudomonas, and we had to draw the line somewhere. So we decided that was 1,000 colony-forming units per mil, but we may or may not have been right with that. Now, 11%, 9 out of the 79, had Pseudomonas cultured in the OP but not in the BAL. So, as was pointed out before, the OP culture may over-represent what's going on in the lower respiratory tract. But at the end of the 5 years, only one child with previous chronic Pseudomonas chronic Pseudomonas infection on BAL actually cultured Pseudomonas at the age of 5. So in the BAL study, we were able to accurately predict that one child was chronically infected. The standard group, we did OP cultures and no BALs until the age of 5. And in this group, 43 out of 76 children, so 57% in the standard group, had Pseudomonas cultured. Now, 2 out of the 43 had Pseudomonas cultured at the age of 5, having cleared the infection previously on OP, and they had the same genotype in the BAL at age 5 compared to the OP culture early on. Was that reinfection? Was that persistent infection? So were they chronically infected? We don't know. We'd called them not chronically infected because they didn't have Pseudomonas on repeat cultures throughout. We also had 4 children who had chronically cultured Pseudomonas on their OP cultures, but none of those children had it in the BAL at the end. So there's an importance to the site of collection. Serial Pseudomonas BAL cultures mostly had different genotypes. So 12 out of 14 children had different genotypes. However, the serial OP cultures, only 3 out of 11 children had different genotypes. So genotype substitutions were more frequent among isolates from BAL than OP cultures, and that was highly statistically significant. But at age 5, there was no difference between the standard group or the BAL group. So the microbiology on BAL was exactly the same. Clinically, there was absolutely no difference between the two. So from the clinical perspective, at age 5, there was no advantage to having had the BAL. So Daniel, let's get back to Daniel. It's unclear whether this is a reinfection or failure to clear. We've got no genotyping. It's also unclear whether the infection is only in the upper airway or is it in the lower airway, as he's well and he's only had OP cultures. Treatment, however, is likely to be successful for the lower respiratory tract even if the infection has persisted in the upper airway. So treatment's going to work regardless. That's what I think. So treat, and does it matter how we treat? Well, you've looked at these studies, we've been through them, and they basically all show you that eradication does work, but there is some failure. Now, the optimal therapy is still not known, but successful eradication does reduce chronic infection. We also think that the minimal therapy should be 1 month of inhaled tobramycin or colistin and ciprofloxacin. So exactly what do we need to do once treatment is finished? Well, we're going to check OP cultures once the treatment's completed. We're back here again. So we've got to make a decision about whether we're chronically infected or whether this is an ongoing intermittent infection. So if he's still Pseudomonas positive, and now we're in a nearly evidence-free zone, what are we going to do? Are we going to admit that this is, are we going to say this is chronic infection? Are we going to give up on this young child? Remember, he's under the age of 5. And we do know that there is an increased risk with chronic infection, particularly in younger children. So we're going to try another treatment. Are we going to give it another go? We're going to switch therapies. Now, if the OP culture remains Pseudomonas positive, then do we think he's going to be chronically infected after that? And would we consider a BAL to determine whether he really has chronic infection? So exactly what do we need to do once the treatment's finished? If he's Pseudomonas negative after treatment's completed, do we think he's intermittently infected? So we keep culturing OP cultures, and if he becomes Pseudomonas positive again, do we start again? But what if within 12 months you've got 3 positive cultures? What do we do? He might have cleared each time, but if you look back, over half his cultures in that 12 months are positive. Again, I'm afraid we're in an evidence-free zone in terms of what to do. Do we change tack with treatment again? Do we admit him to hospital? Do we use a different eradication regimen? Do we consider BAL? So I think this brings us very nicely to the discussion.
One of the things that came up is culturing and reculturing people. When would you think it's a good time to reculture after you're treating somebody? Margaret, do you want to start as a right when you finish or a year
I'd be
later?
Happy to start. I think that there's a lack of standardization or evidence base there either. I think one really critical message that Ron Gibson found in his study that Harm Tiddens alluded to is that it's very important not to obtain an OP culture while the patient is actively still on an inhaled antibiotic, because oral contamination with that antibiotic can actually inhibit growth of Pseudomonas that might be there. So in our clinic, we typically wait 1 to 2 weeks after completion of therapy. Our protocol is typically 28 days of therapy, obtain a culture a week or two later, and if still positive, then a second month of therapy.
Harm, would you do it that way? Or?
Yeah, we have as a routine that we try to get 6 cultures within a short time frame after completion of the eradication therapy, and we give the patients the cotton wool swabs in agar to the home with envelopes, and they send it to us. So we get within a couple of, let's say 2 months, we get like 6 cultures.
Claire?
Our treatment protocols are a little bit more like Margaret's, but we also quite often admit our children to hospital for 2 weeks of IV antibiotics, to be honest, and then we give them the inhaled Toby. Children are completely asymptomatic, we usually just use inhaled, but many kids actually do have a cough, and the kids who do have a wet cough we'll often bring into hospital.
So you bring up, that's a great question, but I had several people ask questions about IV antibiotics. Is that the break point, if there's some symptoms, that's when you'd go with IV?
Well, we actually don't know yet. We actually have no evidence on that, and it's going to be very important to look at the results of the torpedo study when that comes out, and it's going to be very important to have a look. We go with the 2 weeks of IV antibiotics really because the BAL study had remarkably low prevalence of chronic pseudomonas at the end of 5 years, and we used 2 weeks of IV antibiotics with 2 months of inhaled Toby and a month of Cipro. It was a very, very aggressive treatment protocol, but at the end of the day, we had very little chronic infection. So that's why we're doing it, but it's not really good evidence.
No, and you bring up a good point, because we were talking about a month of Toby or a month of Aztreonam or a month of colistin ciprofloxacin, but other places use longer courses of therapy. Are we going about it the wrong way, or we're just looking for the minimal approach? Margaret, what do you think?
Well, I love Clara's idea of an evidence-free zone, because that's definitely what we're in. I think there was some very interesting data that was just presented today by Nicole Hamlet from the EPIC clinical trial, which looked at the duration of remaining pseudomonas-free if you're remain pseudomonas-free for a year after receiving 28 or 56 days of inhaled tobramycin, and that rate was really pretty high. So we tend to be less aggressive, but again, it's just, you know, we're working with evidence we have.
So the EPIC trial showed that adding ciprofloxacin didn't add a whole lot to the therapy with inhaled antibiotic. But someone asked a question about CARM's data, which is, well, there's all this diseased lung in there. Wouldn't an oral antibiotic be helpful, or?
Yeah, I think especially for the failed eradication, I think really have to phenotype up patients properly, and in the clinical trial networks have to compare various strategies, and then try to predict the result from the phenotyping of our patients. And definitely I think that the CT scan gives you important information on the volume of lung you cannot reach with an aerosol. And it's actually now in the review of microbiology or something like that, it is a tremendous large review on aerosolized antibiotics, and they explain the complexity of an antibiotic. It has to be soluble and not bind to your sputum, and all those factors play a role. So there are certain antibiotics from IV you can go a little bit into the lumen, and other antibiotics that from the lumen maybe you can get some of the antibiotics in the airway wall, and those things all might play a role. So I would think phenotype our patients and do have several protocols, and let's see what comes from that.
So I asked Marianne about treating, and she said she was going to think about it. So Donna, what do you do when she says no? I don't want to do therapy.
Well, I'm sure there'll be a discussion around what are her concerns, because she may have maybe some misconceptions about side effects or things that she does. So clarifying what her concerns are, and again, probably reinforcing if, you know, we wait, what the pros and cons are of waiting. Typically, a lot of the families, if they're really concerned about it, really, when they make me spell Pseudomonas, I know that they're going onto the internet, and then I get all these questions about, you know, the damage and the, you know, the prognosis and all that. So, I would hope that, you know, we could give her some information that would just help her understand pros and cons of waiting.
So it's interesting. We started talking about what sort of questions we're going to get and various things. The question that came up that I hadn't thought of at all, but is several people I asked, is what about other kinds of Pseudomonas? Is this just for Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or what do you do about fluorescens and putada and all those other things? Or other? Margaret, what do you do?
That's a great question. Again, comes down to evidence. We have no evidence that the non-aeruginosa pseudomonads are of concern or are pathogens, so at least in our clinic we typically do not treat them. Uh-oh. Our man is down. Do you guys have differing approaches?
Work your way down the aisle there.
Well, we do treat them sometimes. So if we've picked it up on a BAL and there's quite a lot of it there, then yes, we do treat it. And we've sometimes had children where it's the only culture positive in a sputum, and you go, what are we going to do? The child's coughing, he's got a wet cough, that's what you're culturing, we treat it.
But I think, to be fair, that's slightly different than just this asymptomatic kid who shows up with
that. That I wouldn't treat. If it's an asymptomatic child and it's just there, I wouldn't treat it. But it's completely logical, really, isn't it? I mean, we're treating Pseudomonas aeruginosa when the child's got no symptoms, but we're, I mean, it doesn't really...
Well, this is the moment for an audience poll. This isn't an ARS. I was told we're doing ARS questions, so don't go away. But we can have an informal audience poll. So for Pseudomonas fluorescens, how many people would treat that in an asymptomatic child? Hands up. How many people wouldn't treat it? Leave it alone. I think there's more leave it alone than treat it out there in the group. Okay. So I think I have a few minutes more to talk a couple more questions because they're really a unique opportunity, I think, to have people from around the world to talk about Pseudomonas eradication. One of the things that came up is bronchoscopy and talking about that. When do you factor that into your practice? Is that every time people, a routine thing or something that you do when people fail therapy, when they're sick? Margaret, you want to start that one?
Yeah, so I think that's one area where practices around the world do vary quite a bit. And again, due to lack of standardized recommendations or protocols, we typically have a fairly high threshold for bronchoscopy, maybe more than some other centers even in the United States. So we've come to think that having Pseudomonas in the upper airway itself may be important, and so we'll treat there. And we typically reserve bronchoscopy for failure of antimicrobial treatment directed towards the pathogen that was isolated from the upper airway.
Carl?
Yeah, we have your routine use biannual CT scan. And if we cannot explain the progression on the CT scan through cultures, then we do a bronchoscopy going to the sites where we see the structure abnormalities. And I think we often, so that sometimes we find Pseudomonas, but it might also be Aspergillus or atypical mycobacteria.
Now you bring up a wonderful point. This is a challenge in this age group to get objective measures of lung function. There are some pulmonary function testing you can do in little kids. There's LCI, someone asked about, as a up-and-coming therapy perhaps, although still in the research stages, and CT scan, which is available widely, but I don't think widely used on a routine basis.
Well, in Europe now it's about, I would say, of the ECFS clinical trial network centers, it's, I think, about 70%, 60%, 70% use it routinely now.
Claire, what about you? What are your thoughts?
Well, we probably have the same sort of use of BAL as Margaret does, actually. So having used BAL a lot, we wound that right back when the BAL study was finished, because the evidence really didn't show any clinical benefit, so we stopped doing it. And we did pick Aspergillus and Steno and all sorts of other things, but unfortunately, what we found was that despite the fact that we did aim treatment at what we found, at the end of 5 years, there did not appear to be any difference in the microbiology, regardless of what we'd done, and no difference clinically. So we stopped doing it. I have wondered, though, whether we should look at things like LCI more aggressively in young children, and in particular for monitoring children, as you were mentioning, but really to look at how we target inhaled therapies, because you do wonder whether if you have inhomogeneity, you might actually have worse deposition. And I had wondered whether anybody started to look at that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think, as Ron points out, this is a very important issue. Are there downsides to doing therapy? We're talking about doing throat cultures and doing therapy. Are there, we talked about the pros and the good things. Are there downsides to this, you think, harm?
There is some over-treatment probably, because there was a study from Utrecht showing that you can have like temporary colonization. So every time we jump on it. So we for sure over-treat somewhat. And of course, any antibiotic will be a disturbance of your microbiome. So But the curves show that overall it's worth it, I think.
And what about Daniel or other people? When do we say that they're colonized? And stop with this eradication therapy? Is there a point where you'd say enough is enough and we're going to be on chronic therapy?
I think Claire gets to take that one.
Claire's going to take that one. She brought it up. Three cultures in a year? Three cultures in 6 months?
Look, I used to say yes to that, but I've actually stopped. And the reason for that is that we've actually found that families hate it once a young child is regarded as chronically infected. And the families have often gone, well, can we not just try one more time? And so we've often given in to that and said, well, okay, let's try one more time, but let's do something different. So we'll often completely switch around. So the first 2 times we'll usually use Toby. The last time we'll probably just switch to another inhaled antibiotic, and we have colistin, we don't have aztreonam available, so we usually go for colistin and ciprofloxacin and try that, and we always, if we're going to do that, we usually bring them into hospital as well. So we just give it an all-out go and see how we go, and occasionally we get lucky, but it's quite difficult when you've got a family in front of you saying, I really don't want to be chronically infected, can we try this again? Mm-hmm. And we actually need desperately some studies. We really do. We need to know how best to treat reinfection and whether, you know, and how often we can treat reinfection before we call it chronically infected. And maybe we should be all doing antibody tests to predict the ones that are going to fail. But I'm not 100% sure that even that's going to work.
Margaret, your thought on antibodies or...
Yeah, you know, on a population basis in early infection, there is some, antibodies are weakly predictive of success or failure of eradication, but I think the area under the curve is not great, so I think with an individual patient in front of you, they're not particularly helpful.
No, I echo what you say about labeling somebody as chronic, and we've often taken the approach of let's do 3 cycles and see where we are at the end of 3 cycles. And someone asked a question about azithromycin. We didn't really talk about azithromycin. Mm-hmm. Is there a role for azithromycin in all this? Margaret?
That's the OPTIMIZE study that's just being started now. So stay tuned and we'll know in about 5 years.
What's that study?
So the OPTIMIZE study is a randomized controlled trial of tobramycin solution for inhalation at first isolation of Pseudomonas in kids 0 to 15 years of age, and then again whenever Pseudomonas is re-isolated from an OP culture. And then in addition, they're randomized to receive either azithromycin or placebo thrice weekly for the 18-month trial duration. And the primary endpoints are microbiologic as well as pulmonary exacerbations.
And Claire mentioned the Torpedoes trial, which is a trial of IV antibiotics. It's being done in the UK to look at the addition of IV antibiotics on top of colistin and ciprofloxacin as an approach to therapy. Again, with the idea that we really don't know what we're doing in many cases as far as the optimal, let me rephrase that. We don't know the optimal approach. We recommend particular courses of antibiotics as Trianam or tobramycin or colistin, but there isn't an absolutely best therapy for a particular child, and all of these may be effective. I think we're getting to the end of our time. We did start a little bit late, and I know we're running a little bit over. I guess the last question I want to end with, and what people have asked, is does this signal that you should do additional therapy in some way? You know, you get Pseudomonas, should you do something different with mucolytics or something that you weren't doing before, or can you just do your Toby therapy or your aztreonam therapy and that's good? Does this signal something changed for you?
Well, clean your nebulizer.
You clean your nebulizer?
Yeah, for sure. It might be the source.
But is this a change? Do you change your practice otherwise other than doing the therapy for the infection?
Well, since abnormal mucociliary clearance is at the root of why these patients are becoming infected with Pseudomonas to begin with, we definitely reinforce airway clearance, and we might decide to start another therapy like Pulmozyme or hypertonic saline in the age range in which there's no evidence base to do that if kids are getting recurrently infected with Pseudomonas.
Claire?
Yeah, we'd do the same. We would actually consider using Pulmozyme early, and in fact there was an interesting symposium this morning looking at the effect of Pulmozyme on releasing Pseudomonas that might be stuck in a biofilm, and then with that release you think you might be able to kill off the antibiotics kill off the bugs with the antibiotics. But you know, whether that works is a whole other issue, and we just don't know. But yes, we would think about starting Pulmozyme in patients with recurrent Pseudomonas infection.
Okay, so I am going to ask you another question. I'm going to ask you the other end of this, which is just in my little stack here. So if someone is on chronic therapy, we're moving away from eradication, but you're on chronic therapy and they're no longer culturing Pseudomonas, do you stop? Harm?
Yeah, we do after 2 years negative.
2 years?
Yeah, and then we try to stop. And of course, I have not looked into systematically, but my idea is that I would say 9 out of 10, you culture within weeks again your Pseudomonas. So a very effective suppressive therapy, but many of those patients, they relapse after stopping.
Margaret, did you?
Similar approach, though. We don't have a defined period of 2 years, and probably similar findings. The only thing I would say is that in these very young kids where it's not exactly clear how to define chronic Pseudomonas, I think we have a higher success rate in being able to take them off because maybe they were really just intermittently colonized instead of chronically colonized.
Claire?
Yeah, I agree. We would probably be more aligned with Margaret's plan on that. We don't have a set time of 2 years, but each of the physicians does something slightly differently.
Well, I'd like to thank our panel. I think that the presentations have been very, very good, and I want to thank Daniel and his mother for being part of all this, and I want to thank you for coming and being part of this presentation.